December 7th, 1941, our land of freedom was defined.
After Pearl Harbor was attacked on December 7th, 1941, it took the music business all of 3 days to package, publish, and record this song.
We did it before, and we can do it again.
First airing on radio, December 10th of that year. So someone alive at that time heard news reports of the tragic events.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
And then Roosevelt's speech on December 8th.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
And then, along with boys going off to war, the culture of the war started to emerge.
How it happened and how we remember it kind of come together. And popular memory is cultural memory.
Philip Beidler's book, The Good War's Greatest Hits, is subtitled World War II and American Remembering. It's about history and memory.
I think those things always combine. They always come to us through popular culture images, you know.
What do we recall and understand about that era? Beidler believes it was that war that could effectively be called the first media war. It was instantly surrounded, sold, and transformed by cultural expressions of every variety.
You have all these different mass communication media feeding off each other and offering something different.
Thomas Dougherty of Brandeis University is the author of Projections of War, Hollywood, American Culture, and World War II.
So life, of course, gives you the marvelous full-page pictures that you can examine. Radio gives you the oral immediacy of it. People like Edward R. Murrow would take you up in a B-17 over Germany during a bombardment.
The sky ahead was lit up by bright yellow flares. Off to starboard, another kite went down in flames. The flares were sprouting all over the sky, reds and greens and yellows. And we were flying straight for the center of the fireworks.
Newsreels, of course.
And the president's words meant action. As billions
the first of them appeared less than a week after the Pearl Harbor attack. But the dramatic feature films about the war were a genre in themselves.
During World War II, we don't know we're going to win the war. So those movies are actually, much more severe, mature than some of the movies made afterwards. They really want to give Americans harsh lessons about the nature of heroism, the sheer terror of the enemy, and the power of the enemy.
One of those was Air Force, the 1943 film about a B-17 bomber, the crew all working together to accomplish a dangerous mission. It was a message picture, like many of the era.
Now look, Wanaki. There are two other men on this ship who washed out as pilots.
The message of these films is that no one individual is more important than another individual.
We need you, just like we need the whole gang. It takes all of us to make this ship function.
In Air Force, the hero is the combat squad.
Every man has got to rely on every other man to do the right thing at the right time. You played football, Wanaki. You know how one man can gum up the whole works.
Part of the message of these films also was that of a tolerant America, unified against its enemy. The idea of the harmonious melting pot, whether it was true or not.
There's only one city in the USA, and that's New York.
Oh, you're just another hometown hick, Weinberg. What's wrong with California?
You have these sort of statistically apportioned ethnic groups that, happen to be on every plane or any combat squad, and you got the Brooklyn Jew, the Boston Irishman, the Iowa farm boy, the guy named Tex, and all these different American ethnicities and regions, all, of course, working together to defeat the Nazi enemy.
Minneapolis? Why, the grass still grows in the streets. Besides that,
America's melting pot image was a useful and necessary way of putting off our own issues in a time of war. And in some ways, the popular culture was way ahead of the reality. You could almost say the propaganda charted a course for America.
At the end of the war, you can't go back, right? You can't go back to a culture that's a Jim Crow culture or a culture that doesn't embrace different ethnicities and sensibilities. So right after the Second World War, not coincidentally, Jackie Robinson in 1947 enters Major League Baseball, Truman integrates the armed forces in 48, Hollywood begins making its first really unapologetic social problem films about American racism.
They call me a dirty Jew and a stinking kite.
The Academy Award for Best Picture of 1947 went to Gentlemen's Agreement, the film about American anti-Semitism.
Immediately after the war, all this stuff sort of just, you know, spews out in American culture and American cinema.
So memory, history, popular culture, and experience all shift and trade places over time to create a certain kind of recollection.
Real things happen, and part of reality is that they get assimilated, you know, into our lives, made sense of, and passed down.
Professor James Young writes about history and memory in books like At Memory's Edge and The Texture of Memory. Growing up, his favorite post-war TV show was the series Combat.
Everything that happened in that war, from the TV programs, the popular, you know, cultural, you know, representations of it, the books I read, the stories I heard, really did shape all of our lives through the 60s especially. So we were somehow thinking of war all the time, a big war, even a third world war. And that did shape us for better or worse.
For a long time, the World War II myth held strong. America as the noble face for good democratic values that must be fought for.
And then the Vietnam ethos, which is that there are times in which America is the villain in foreign affairs and that it can get involved in meaningless wars that send back nothing but body bags. And those tend to be the two different dynamics that America now faces whenever it's confronted with another foreign policy adventure.
Now, in the absence of a clear popular cultural presence of our current war, a divided nation is looking back, and the war myths are battling it out to see which one will prevail for the next generation. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.